Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 134, with guests Aaron White from the Phil and Film podcast and MJ Smith from the Before and After show. So listen up, because we've got a theory-laced show for you. On this episode, we talk passengers and pen names, fan theories, and online dating.
I mean, we're going to talk about Passengers, which is a movie that came out in 2016, a year that we are, you know, for the most part, I think all agreeing that was a down year, maybe not a bad year, you know, depending on, you know, how you want to actually grade it. But it was so at the forefront of conversations in the Real World Theology discussion group that I felt like we owed it to 2016 and to ourselves to at least talk about it for a little while. And
the greatest trailer debate of all time.
Yeah, the greatest.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, and it was, it had the potential to be a really great movie. And despite it being good or bad, because wherever you fall on that spectrum, there was so much to talk about. I mean, you could tell there's going to be so much to talk about just from the trailer. So I was like, we're going to find a time. We're going to find a chance. We're going to talk about this, whether people like it or not, because it's amazing for a movie that did so poorly with the critics and, you know, didn't, I'm sure, do near as good as they wanted it to at the box office. There's a surprising number of people who actually ended up seeing it, even though they're like, oh, it's got terrible ratings, I'm going to skip it. I mean, but why is it that anytime we have a social media discussion about this movie, everyone has an opinion because they've seen it? So...
Yeah, it's true. I tried to get my wife to get it from the library she works at, and they had 14 people who had it on hold ahead of me, and I ended up having to Redbox it.
Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, so it's an original sci-fi film with two beautiful and charming leads, you know, like, two of the hottest, not like probably physically hottest and like, you know, star power hottest up-and-coming stars in Hollywood, and it only managed to score, what, a whopping 31% on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, we've had the conversation, like, how important is Rotten Tomatoes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, I think it is still indicative of a movie that I know made Real World Theology's, like, most anticipated, not only, like, of 2016, but, you know, the second half of 2016. Like, all signs kept pointing to this being a good movie. And I because of expectations... Even though I enjoyed the film, it still was one of the more disappointing films. And I know it disappointed a lot of people in the Real World Theology community. But I'm kind of curious just like what happened, because I'm having a really hard time figuring out why it misfired so bad. And I'm kind of curious. I know we've all had a lot of conversations about it, but like Aaron, you know, like, have you come up with some kind of theory about why people... like we're so down on the film?
Well, I have a few things that I think are the specific reasons why, and I think one of them, I think you nailed number one, which is expectations.
Yeah.
In fact, earlier you were talking about the fact that in 2016 you started having the feeling of, does it take so much to excite you because you see so many movies, because this is something that we do a lot of. I think that is a very real feeling and a real reaction, specifically for critics. Anytime critics really go against the public grain on a film, I think that might have something to do with it, because the general public seeing, what, I don't know, 5, 6, maybe 10 tops movies a year.
Yeah, maybe.
And then they're rewatching Princess Bride and Top Gun at home over and over and over.
Like they should.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think for them, it does take a lot less to have a good movie experience, where the more and more we see, the more and more we have to compare to, we become more critical and more, you know, we need more from the films. But, yeah, I think the expectations, I mean, when I first saw the film, I was much more where I think you are right now, Mikey, which is it's not horrible and it was very entertaining. Mm-hmm. But you didn't absolutely love it. I remember coming out of it and I was disappointed. I mean, I was the same thing that almost everybody else was. I was like, what in the world? Because we got duped, right? We weren't expecting what we got. And so
yeah,
I think there's a subset of people that can't get past that for sure.
Well, it's really interesting too, because I remember, you know, I had exceptionally high expectations. And then, you know, in the week or two leading up to when I actually had a chance to see it, the reviews were so bad. I mean, like, they were just trashing this film. I think my expectations did a 180. So when I went to see it, I was like, hey, sweetie, I'm going to go watch this terrible movie because I can't not see it because, haha, it's a running joke, right? And when I got done watching it, I was like, well, I mean, there's some problems. And, I mean, like, not just, like, cinematic problems. Like, there is some, like, ethical and, you know, male, female kind of problems, social issues in this film that maybe were glossed over a little too easily. But outside of that, if I can set some of that to the side a little bit, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. So I wasn't really disappointed the first time. I mean, overall, I'm disappointed because I wanted it to be one of the best films of the year. But like when I walked out of the theater, I was like, I don't feel so bad about spending money on that. I've spent money on far worse, Transformers. So, you know.
Yeah, I I agree. I had a kind of a similar experience to you, Mikey. My expectations weren't super high for it, actually, to begin with. I'm on record as not being the hugest fan of either of the leads. So that, like, I already kind of had tempered expectations, but then the reviews came out and I was like, holy cow, like, this is beyond what I thought was going to be the reception to it. Even I figured it would get, you know, lukewarm at best, maybe, but people ravaged this thing. And so I had a friend that told me they wanted to see it with me, and I was like, okay. They live out of town and I only see them maybe twice a year. And I was like, you know, for you, I will go see this thing. And so by the time I saw it, the movie had been out for almost 3 weeks. And so all the reviews and reactions had entered my brain. And when we came out, we were like, well, that wasn't as bad as everyone said, but it wasn't like that good either. It was for me, it was like very much the lukewarm reception that I originally anticipated for it, rather than the, you know, absolute mob of people with pitchforks and torches that came after it.
You almost went on an unnecessary roller coaster. You're like, yeah, this is what I expected the whole time. Why did we go on this? It's going to be great. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah. I ended up back at the station.
Well, Aaron, so you mentioned that there's a number of things that you feel maybe went wrong with it. So I think we're all on the page. And you know, again, we've talked about this with many films. Expectations can lead to such unequal disappointment or surreal enjoyment of a film when you thought you were going to hate it. But outside of expectations, the film itself, like, is there something specific that it does that really missed the mark? Like, did the trailer promise you something that the film didn't deliver? I mean, was it not original enough for you? What was it that really missed the mark?
Well, originally for me, it was the fact that it was a romance, the jukiness of it, the not getting what I expected. I expected more of, I don't know what I expected to be. I guess I expected action. I just didn't. I think there's just such a shock factor when you first experience what Jim is doing in waking Aurora up. It's,
yeah.
Are we? Oops. Spoilers. There's that.
Oh no. One, if you haven't seen this film by now, I feel like you're probably not going to do it unless you're one of the 14 people waiting at like MJ's library.
MJ's library.
But yeah. So yeah. Feel free to spoil anything, guys. When we talk about this, we're going to talk about the whole film. So. If you haven't seen it, you'd probably see it. Then come back and listen to the episode, da 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 da, et cetera, et cetera. The thing I say every time.
Okay. Well, that being said, yeah. So when Jim wakes Aurora up, I think, you know, we're all thrown for a loop at that moment. And so we have to process that. And I think what has happened is so many people that I've talked to online and so many reviews I've read have never gotten past that moment. So when that occurs, they are stuck in it. They are, I don't know if it's the, you know, feminist culture that we live in may apply somewhat, but just in general, this idea of like how horrible of an act that is, people cannot move past it. And it informs their rest of the viewing of the movie, and it informs everything that they think about it. It just, they are stuck in that place. And I think tied to that point, we live in a world that does not understand what real love is, what sacrificial love is, and it sure as heck doesn't understand real forgiveness or selflessness. And that is what this movie shows us, I believe. And I've come to believe, I didn't walk out of it the first time feeling that way. It took several viewings before it really started hitting home for me. But now I see it as one of the best portraits of true forgiveness and romance, and just the way that the romance happens. I'm not saying that I approve of it necessarily for these characters. I'm just saying I appreciate seeing it depicted on film because it's a realistic manner of how love has to happen for it to be real and lasting, I think. And so I don't think we live in a world that understands that. And so when they see that, they're not okay with it because they see Aurora's choice as this victim mentality, or like, why would she ever choose him? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a terrible narrative decision on the writers versus, wow, that is amazing that she would actually love this guy. How, you know, that's incredible. People don't want to see that.
So I would push back and ask this, because I don't necessarily disagree a lot of what you're saying, but should we be so easily able, because I think that's what it comes down to. It's not that people are unwilling to move past it. It's that I would agree that I think the film kind of quickly moves past this thing, this act, kind of saying like, well, it's done. It's in the past. Let's just forget about it. Should there be more time there? Is there no place for even people who misunderstand or don't understand what love is, or have a culturally appropriated version of what love is, to not be outraged about this action and say maybe it should have cost someone a little bit more?
I mean, I don't think so. I think the movie does a fine job of it. I mean, we see Aurora go through several stages. We see the shock stage of first realizing what he's done. She doesn't talk to him. She wants nothing to do with him. She wants to separate herself. Then she goes crazy and tries to beat the living crap out of him and physically attack him. The rage comes out. I mean, it depicts to me, very well how upset she is and how much she is completely distancing herself from Jim. And then, you know, it ultimately gets to the point where she reluctantly is helping him. She's doing things with him because they kind of have to. She's not necessarily doing them because she wants to, but they both agree that they got to save everybody on the ship. It's not just about them anymore. And so I feel like she does go through this progressive kind of story to get to the point where she comes full circle and in which she makes the ultimate choice. And I get, you know, I think that's what everybody's hang up is whether or not you believe she's making the choice to stay with Jim and stay awake, whether you consider that agency and she's choosing that, or whether you consider her manipulated,
like duped.
Right. Yeah. And I think how you view that will largely impact, you know, your ultimate decision on what you think the film is trying to say. Mm. And I don't think the film is trying to say anything. That's another thing that I guess I don't think it's trying to tell us, hey, it's cool to go ahead and do this because it'll work out. You know, it's just showing us one potential vision of what could take place. We could have another movie that goes the opposite direction where she gets back in the hot hibernation pod and she's like, screw you, I'm going back to sleep. It's not my problem. And then, you know, Jim lives on his own and dies on the ship, and Aurora makes it to the colony.
Mm.
So I wonder if people would be okay with that.
Yeah. So, well, so MJ, like, what are your thoughts? Like, do you feel like, I mean, I'm assuming that you think this is a very, very, awful thing that he, you know, he chooses for Aurora initially, but do you think the film sticks with it enough? Or, hey, do you even think it's that bad of a decision?
I do think it's a bad decision, but I also think it's kind of an understandable one.
Mm-hmm.
That need for companionship. I think honestly where it does get sticky for most people is because of the way it's gendered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I when I rewatched this movie for the show, I watched it with my wife who had not seen it, and she was like, well, I kind of get where he's coming from. He's been alone for a year and 3 months or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I feel like I'd be tempted to do that too. And I was like, yeah, I agree. But would you do it to a guy?
Yeah.
I think that's where, you know, the main problem for a lot of people is he doesn't want like someone to like hang out and drink beer with. He wants like a romantic relationship out of that. And so that, I think that's where it gets really sticky for some people. My problem with it is that I think the movie doesn't really do a good enough job of a couple things. One, characterizing Jim as either a romantic or a creep. I think it kind of tries to have its cake and eat it too with both of those. And I understand that in real life, quotes around that phrase, it would be more, it wouldn't be a clear cut, oh, he is a creep, he is, you know, a romantic guy.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's no clear, it doesn't convey anything to the audience. And that's the other thing is, I feel like Jim is kind of the audience conduit character. And then when he makes this decision that we don't agree with, we don't want to root for him anymore, but we only see Aurora through his eyes. And so we don't really get to know her very well. So she can't kind of take the reins from that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I don't know. It's hard to like the problem it sets up is really interesting and good to talk about, but the movie never really resolves on it. Not that it should, but it also is just like, I don't know. You deal with this.
Yeah.
To the audience.
Well, and that's what's interesting about it, because I like what Elijah Davidson pointed out in his review, because he talks about how a lot of people are hung up, just kind of like you're talking about, Aaron, on this one thing, basically, you know, kind of damning decision that he's made. And then it points to the fact that, you know, Aurora has no agency throughout the rest of the film, which isn't true. She's woken up. She doesn't know why she's awake. She assumes it's a malfunction. And then it's completely her agency that allows her to, you know, kind of fall for Jim in the first place. Like, Jim never forces himself on her. Like, he does do a terrible, like, he does do something that is, like, he keeps it from her. And it's a big secret to keep. But nowhere is he, like, you know, like I said, like, sneaking into a room at night, like, taking weird, creepy pictures. Like, we don't see him as a creep. And all her decisions to be with him, outside of the knowledge that he woke her up, she falls for him as he is. So if anything, she has a lot of agency, just not about this one thing. And sure, we can all agree that he probably should have told her, or we can agree that maybe he shouldn't have woke her up. But the thing that was disappointing to me outside of all that is that I get that he's lonely, and I want to talk about that loneliness to some degree. But after she wakes up, I feel like this movie, when you boil it down, I wanted a super awesome kind of sci-fi, kind of like you're saying there, and maybe it was action that I wanted, who knows, but it just seemed like a generic romantic comedy. It seemed like tons of romantic comedy plots I've seen before where, you know, girl A meets guy A, and one of them, whichever one, it doesn't matter. It's really interchangeable, pretends they're something they're not, or hides something like, oh, this is while you were sleeping or something like that. This is You've Got Mail. You know, like these are all these movies where one character enters in a romantic relationship and they don't force anything upon the other person. They just keep a very they keep a secret to varying degrees from the other person. And then at the end, someone finds out, and then they have the main conflict of the dark hour of the soul or dark night of the soul, where they're both split and they're like, oh, can I love him even though he lied, or can I love her even though she's not a whatever, whatever. And then something happens and brings them back together. And that's the end of Passengers. That's the entire like second and third act of Passengers. That's not new, and that's kind of boring, and I wanted a little bit more than that. But I don't see anyone being forced to do anything. but I want to circle back to this idea of, Aaron, when you mentioned that this movie actually is an incredible picture of forgiveness, while I'm not sure what the Christian community perspective is on this. Like, if people are, like, general Christian audiences are really hung up on this or not, or maybe they see something different. But I know at least broadly culturally, people say the thing he did is irredeemable.
Mm-hmm.
And she, what does she say? What does she say? She talks to Gus when Gus woke up, and Aurora says something to the effect, I'm going to paraphrase, I can't remember the exact quote, but like you saw the pods, like, you know what he did. And he's like, yeah, I get it. He's like, that's between you guys. And she's like, he killed me or something. Like he sentenced me to death basically, or he murdered me. And all Gus says is like, you know, the drowning man will always drag somebody down. It ain't right, but the man's drowning. I think,
well, there,
yeah, go ahead.
There's also another way to look at that. And I mean, if we're going to look at this from a Christian's perspective, you know, in Genesis, it talks about it's not good for man to be alone. And so there's a point here of the absolute living in isolation and living alone is not the design that we had for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, because of that, that can very seriously would call into question the value of even being alive for Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and my co-host on my show actually pointed this out too. So I don't want to completely steal it from him, but Patrick had told me this. When we were talking about it, and he had said, you know, think of it as she's saving Jim's life in some ways. In a sense, him making the decision to ultimately wake Aurora up is about his own survival, because he needs that companionship to live as well. And so she has a role in that. And again, this is not a concept that the world is going to ever accept or be okay with, because it's all about me, right? Who cares if Jim lives alone and dies? It doesn't matter. It's fine, because I'll do my thing in the pod, you know?
Well, doesn't that beg the question, like, is altruism if it's forced? You know, it's like, hey, when you're voluntold to do something, like, do you get a thank you card if you're voluntold? You know, like, no one really appreciate your sacrifice. And it goes to a lot of political questions and, like, who's charge of, you know, keeping the poor? It's not... I don't want to be told to do this. I want to do it for my own free will. And there is something more beautiful, I believe, about doing something like that out of your free will, instead of being woken up and saying, you're going to die now. But hey, bright side, you're basically saving this guy's life. Like, is that really going to make your day better?
No, I don't think it. I don't think it's not in a worldview that doesn't include Christ and eternity. Because this is all we've got. So if you're living your life believing that your one fleeting, you know, or your however many years of 60, 70 years of fleeting time in existence is all there is, then heck no. I mean, that's, of course, people are going to fight for their survival and fight for everything that they want for their own. But you know, for Christians, it doesn't have to be like that. We can make those sacrifices because we know that this is not all there is. So Aurora losing her quote unquote freedom to live her life as she wants for, you know, 30 or 40 more human years is really nothing in the big scheme of things if she's going to spend eternity in heaven.
So if Aurora, I mean, she wants to be famous, you know, she wants to write all these stories and she doesn't get to do that, but that's the dream. And so instead someone says, hey, you need to be able to settle for love instead. And that's probably more important than what you think you were created for. How would you answer that kind of question? Like maybe there's a plot like that to a movie maybe that you saw recently.
What are we talking about? Notebook? I don't know what we're talking about.
No, I was doing the long way around to try to get a La La Land jab in there somewhere.
Oh,
to see if I can get you to contradict yourself, but maybe that was too much. Maybe you're just you don't want to see the contradiction.
I don't know.
Well, okay. So something I am genuinely curious about is, and I think you've kind of answered this, but I'd like you to flesh it out a little bit more, MJ. Is something that I was thinking, especially since the main problem with the film is that, like I said, is the fact that, you know, Aurora is woken up against her will, and then there's a romantic relationship that it involves. And then when the thing comes to light, like people can't even get to that part because, like as Aaron pointed out, it's a big hangup. But you mentioned, you know, the conversation with your wife. Like, what if he would have woken up a guy, and they would have just had like a really, really good male affirming, you know, life together, doing their thing. Like, do you think that would have like raised as many eyebrows, or would people have been like, oh, well, it sucked he did that, but I'm glad that they were able to save the ship?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like if it did go that direction, I think one of two things would have happened. Like, I see two outcomes of that. Either they end up falling for each other romantically, or they end up, one of them ends up still wanting to wake up a woman. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, I have quite a bit of guy friends and I love my guy friends, but like, I would never get married to one of my guy friends. Like, I'm a heterosexual male. And so, you know, and so if I had felt called to a life of singleness, I think it kind of all goes back to what Aaron was saying of whether or not Christ is in these people's worldview or not. Which I know is to any movie we talk about on Real World Theology, but I think it's almost doubly here because if, you know, if they're still portraying this sort of forgiveness aspect of it, or sacrificial love and, you know, what the movie ultimately ends on, I think you can do that and still have a loving, affirming male friendship. And on top of that, you'd be able to explore, I don't want to say the benefits, cause it sounds like one is better than the other, but of just like being single is okay too, because mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of not celebration of singleness in movies.
Yeah.
So I think, or even if you did, from Jennifer Lawrence, like, a female version.
Ryan, you know, Gosling choose singleness in La La Land. Just throwing that out there.
Does, well, it? Yeah. Yeah, does it? He's married to Jazz.
I knew that was coming.
I'm sure that he is not from a Christian perspective, like I have to like keep using this phrase. Yeah. I'm sure that he is lonely in the spiritual sense. But I'm sure that his bed is not cold, so
yeah,
that distinction.
But yeah, so I think if he would have woken someone else up of the same gender and they just have, like, it's just like bro time until we have to save the ship, bro time until Lawrence Fishburne wakes up and kicks off the third act and then dies. I think that you can still have all those themes because I think you can still have the reveal of when Arthur tells him, like, hey, oh yeah, I remember he's really excited to wake you up. Like, he couldn't stop talking about how cool you seemed. And then he's like, you know, whoever you want to put with him is like, hey, like, you can hit all those same beats and then also still have it be, like, resolved with, like, you know what, though? We've forged this friendship over the last year together. Like, we're still in this together and we're still friends. Mm-hmm. And I think you can also have it say something about, like, you can have a fulfilling life and still live a life of singleness on a romantic end.
Mm. I think that almost would be more radical than anything else, because I constantly see the idea, even in Christian circles, like, it's this idea that two guys can be really, really good friends, and not have to lead to, like, the sexual, physical intimacy, or same thing with women. Like, why can't two women be friends? It happens more with guys because there's a little bit of a stigma culturally.
Yeah.
But you know, two people of the same sex being able to have an incredibly rich relationship, and a loving relationship, like a deeply loving relationship that does not have to ultimately resort or, culminate maybe in a physical relationship, that the skewing of relationship in our current culture, saying that the ultimate love is physical love.
Yeah.
When that is really, really antithetical to how, at least from our faith, love is actually portrayed. Because it doesn't, you know, he doesn't say, like, a greater love, you know, hath no more than how much you can share a bed with someone, you know, like, you know, no greater love is this than, you know, getting with your best friend, sexually. You know what I'm saying? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. That would be a great Bible verse. Like, everyone would know that Bible verse.
Yeah, they would.
But that's not, you know, that's not what they say. You know, self-sacrifice is what leads to love. And honestly, if you want to bring it full circle, I think it comes back to, Aaron, what you were saying towards the beginning. I think the willingness to sacrifice oneself, the willingness to try to atone for one's crimes, even though, you know, we're talking about, I get maybe little a atonement, you know, just to differentiate, like, atonement for his own self-perceived sins. Like, Jim's willingness to, like, give up his life to extend Aurora's life is commendable. Does it fully make up for it? Well, does anything we do fully make up for any sin that we commit? You know,
no.
Yeah, we can get into that, but, like, I would say, you know, no, but, and maybe that's the thing. So these are conversations that I've had with plenty of non-Christians. When they say something like, the thing that person did is unforgivable, and I'm like, really? Like, that's the thing for you? Like, what about this? They're like, that's unforgivable too. I'm like, well, what about this? They're like, well, they'd have to be really sorry. I'm like, what does that look like? Like, what does repentance and forgiveness and grace look like in your world? And would you want someone to hold you to the same standard? You know, it's a mixed bag, but I do want to talk about the idea that we briefly hit on with loneliness in general. Aaron, I believe it was you that, you know, even hearkened back to Genesis 2:18 when, you know, God himself says, or God herself, whatever, I don't care. God says it is not good for a man to be alone. And so, you know, he creates Eve. And that might lead to another conversation about, like, you know, if God just wanted people to have like a really good friend, why did God create a woman instead of a man? And obviously God needed both and the image of God. And oh man, there's a lot of tangents there. I'm just going to skip all that right there and just say like, I really want to focus mainly on the loneliness part of it. Over at Think Christian, there's a review for Passengers written by Jake Rabe. I'm sure I butchered his name. Jake, if you're listening, for whatever reason, I'm sorry. He kind of looks at the exploration of loneliness in his review, and he makes this great comparison to C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, and how it depicts hell as a place where people, like, they have comforts, they have things they like to do, they have fun things to do. Like, it's not
bowling night.
What's that?
Bowling night.
Bowling night. Bowling. You know, like, they're not want for anything. You know, it's not like it's just desolate and like you're eating dust and things like that. It's like there are opportunities like that, but despite that, it's basically a place where people forsake community. And to get away from connection with another person, they just move further and further away. So that hell is just this long, ever-expanding, sprawling landscape of people trying to move further and further away from each other. And in that comparison, if we accept it, Jim is in like a literal hell. Like he is what, half the speed of light, you know, flying through space further and further away from anyone he's ever known. Given it's not it is kind of his choice, but in this particular way, it's not his choice. Completely lonely, in a place where he is not doing what he was created to do. And I would say that if we're created in the image of God, which I believe we would agree, and God himself is Trinity, God's never been alone. God created us in his image. We weren't made to be alone. I would think Jim would go insane if he didn't do this. I just don't see how people without a Christian perspective can see that that's okay. And I can forgive someone for doing that. I think for being lonely, I think it makes it tough when the person he wakes up is, you know, really attractive and he wants to have a relationship with them.
So I got something to say about that. That's going to lead into a theory that I want to propose for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So with him is choosing of Aurora. The way I read this is, it's very interesting because I've read quite a bit of criticism about how, you know, oh, Jim's just picking the hottest girl. You know, like he's going around picking he gets to, you know, choose who he wants. But isn't this really just a very condensed like snapshot of what we do anyway? I mean, in essence, Jim is online dating, right? He is crafting he's looking for that perfect person that meets all of the criteria. She's got to, you know, he doesn't get to know her. He doesn't get to talk to her. He's looking at a profile and he's finding someone that matches the check boxes that he's looking for. And so that's exactly what he's experiencing. Is very similar to the way that we meet people in the, you know, 2017. That's how people date, to a large number of people at least. And so I always found that fascinating that he's, you know, he's not necessarily just picking her based on looks, but, you know, he's looking for this set of stuff that he wants. So he does get to choose. And the world would say, or online dating sites would have you believe, that that's how good relationships are created, by looking for the matching qualities.
Those criteria.
Right. Exactly. And I disagree with that. I think you lose a lot of room for discovery and a lot of room for spontaneity. You know, you're taking some of the conflict out of relationship, which I don't know that in this case is necessarily good, just making sure you both have all the same interests, et cetera. So I always found that fascinating how they handled that.
Well, it's like buying a car at that point. Like I think maybe you guys have seen it, but I think it's Auto Trader. The Auto Trader has that commercial where like the person's walking around in like a big wide open space and they're like, I want it to have four doors. And like all these cars flip over and he's like, blue, and it flips over again and reduces and reduces it. And I was like, you know how great it would be if someone made a parody video? Maybe someone has. I can't. It's actually very hard to imagine someone hasn't done this, but does it for like, you know, Match.com or whatever.
And that would be.
And just like have these people. I feel like I have to step in here. I met my wife online.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect.
Way to go, Aaron. Gosh, I can't believe you're making fun of NJ.
I met my ex-wife online. So.
Oh. I see what's happened here.
I'm kidding.
I'm not a PhD. But.
Anyway.
Wait, is it really only... Because I wanted to point out, I was going to wait for you to finish, MJ, but like in my spiel, I was going to say, I don't actually... I'm not sure how down... or against Aaron is against online dating, but like I know a number of people who have met online and it has worked out swimmingly. Now I've known a lot of people who've met online and it has not worked out at all, and there have been terrible, horrible experiences from it. But I mean, in an age where people are completely mobile and socially connected to tons and tons of people and transient, like it does not bother me necessarily how people meet. And actually one of the things that I kind of like, at least I'm assuming because I've not gone through the online dating process, is that most of these criteria that you're filling out like isn't necessarily like you're just, it's not Tinder or whatever. You're not just going like, they're hot, let me talk to them.
Right.
It's like, hey, we have a lot in common and I'll narrow it down based on our common interests. And I mean, then you always have the option after it narrows it down to judge by, you know, outer appearances. But the initial pull is, you know, it's, you know, like, hey, I'm going to a baseball game, and if I meet a girl at a baseball game who's there because she likes baseball and I like baseball, well, great. Like I'm not going, you're knocking out all the people who we're going to not meet in real life anyway. I know you're saying, Aaron, there's that spontaneity thing, but if there's someone who's really into going to like dog shows, I'm probably never going to meet that person because I'm not going to go to a dog show. And so at least the initial piece of online dating is saying MJ doesn't like dog shows. Fizz doesn't like dog shows. Maybe MJ and Fizz can hang out. So, and that part I don't have a problem with, though I do think there are some pitfalls. Now that I've given you all my very expert opinion of someone who's never online dated, I actually kind of curious, as a wonderful tangent, MJ, can you give me your impression of online dating?
Sure. So the relationship with my wife is actually the second online. The second relationship I've had that started online. So out of the two relationships I've had online, I even have a 50% success rate. that's the thing is, you know, they have sections of a profile. And we met, you know, in a pre-Tinder world. Like, Tinder is very much like, that person's hot.
Yeah.
That person's hot. That is literally window shopping for people. Mm-hmm. But most online dating, it's, you know, you have a profile and it has several sections and you fill them out. And it's basically like a long blog post, essentially. And then there are usually additional questions that you can answer as supplemental things. So you can click on someone's questions and see how many questions they've answered. And that was always my main criteria of, you know, you obviously the first thing you get on an online dating thing is a picture of the person. Mm-hmm. So you would decide, oh, that person's cute. And so you would go to their profile. I would immediately click away if they didn't have a super well filled out profile, because one, mine was. And so I was like, well, you're going to know way more about me. And two, you know, it showed that they put in work, that they wanted to try to make a connection on the website, that they were there for something of substance. And so, you know, though, like, it goes beyond, you know, oh, you like dog shows, you don't like dog shows, you like baseball, I don't like baseball. And you can read these blurbs about people and kind of get a sense of if someone filled out their profile thoroughly, you can get a pretty decent sense of how they operate as a person. And then you can message them, and the impetus is on them to message you back. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's the main fall of Passengers, or of the decision that Jim makes in Passengers, is he doesn't get to just message Aurora before he wakes her up to decide this is the one. He sees the initial part of her dating profile, and then it's just like, this one.
Yeah.
So what, and then once you message back and forth and you go on dates and, you know, decide from there. So I think that online dating itself is a really effective tool, and it helped me get a wife, obviously. It helped me find my wife. And actually, if you, the craziest thing about our story is we had the exact same group of friends and had never met before, the same group of friends for about a decade. And so for whatever reason, we were supposed to meet online. and that's honestly, I feel like one of the only ways we would have ended up meeting. And so, but also added into that was on God's time. That's when God wanted us to meet.
Yeah.
So Passengers, and with Passengers, you don't really see him shopping around for people. He slips on a vodka bottle. Is that correct? Aaron, you've probably seen it more recently.
I don't remember that. No,
because he slips on that vodka bottle and ends up in the fetal position. Because he's like drunk and walking through where all the passengers are, and he throws it, and then he like goes on the spacewalk, and then he tries to kill himself through the airlock and decides against it. And then and then he slips on the bottle and ends up in the fetal position. And when he wakes up from passing out because he's drunk, that's when he sees Aurora. But we don't really see him like going around and looking at all the people and being like, oh, that person seems cool, that person doesn't, and going through a bunch of profiles. It's literally the first person he sees.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true.
So it's desperation. That's what you're saying. You're like, literally, I will wake up anyone at this point.
Yeah.
He gets lucky. He gets lucky.
Yeah. We don't really know. Yeah. It's the future. So maybe everyone like is as good looking as Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. Like, that's just, you know, genetic engineering or something like that.
So let me float this theory out to you guys real quick and see what you think about this. Patrick and I discussed this, and I will give him most of the credit for coming up with this. In fact, I had a big aha moment when he told me. But in subsequent viewings of the film, I've watched it through this lens. And I'm curious what you guys think about this specific way of viewing Passengers, but also in general, what you think about watching a movie your own way that may or may not have been the design of the writers. And is that okay? And is it, you know, does it take something away from the movie if you're able to do that? And so the way that I view the film, and it makes me enjoy it a lot more, is why are you laughing already?
Well, it's just because, like, tell me if you guys think this is okay. This is what I did.
is that the ship, which we see to be extremely advanced. It's for goodness sakes, it's self-flying itself, millions or however many light years, putting up a shield to block asteroids. We see multiple times where the ship is rerouting and changing power and things like that to try and fix itself. I believe, watching the movie, that the ship wakes Jim up. And here's the reason to support this. Jim is a mechanic. Jim fixes things. Ship wakes Jim up. Jim goes through this process. Jim wakes Aurora up. That's all on his own. There's nothing there for that. But eventually, the ship is breaking more and more, and it's starting to reach that point of critical failure where it realizes, like, I can't fix myself. And if this, if I don't get fixed soon, we're going to explode. So it wakes up Lawrence Fishburne, right? Which solves the magical Negro potential mm-hmm. here. There's now a reason for him to be awake. And the reason it wakes him up is clearly because he has the bracelet and they need the bracelet. They would never have been able to save the ship without his command bracelet. So I feel like it's set up in a way to where the ship could have initiated this, these actions taking place. And it solves some of the problems for me, because one of my big problems is the him waking up. Like it, if he doesn't wake up, they don't really ever have a way to save the ship. And so it's kind of like, you know, they would have just been doomed.
So
I don't know. What do you,
so you're what makes you enjoy Passengers is a sentient ship. I'm just saying.
It's a fan, and also it's a fan theory.
you know how condescending it says.
It's never been proved. I've Googled this over and over and over looking for answers, and I've never read anything that debunks it or that says that's not true.
I guess we know it's only going to get really bad if we go out there and reread Passengers fanfic where Aaron White is submitting like two vessels are like, you know, romantically involved, the Avalon and the Avalon 2 are holding hands, making baby Avalon ships on some planet in, you know, kind of Twilight. Or there's a vampire ship and it has to fight a werewolf ship.
What is happening?
Okay, I guess
fan theories.
You're not a fan.
No, well, I find it incredibly amusing that, again, in a world that is so socially connected, that is, everyone has kind of like this right to their opinion and their creativity, that they can rewrite their own stories. I mean, like, this is how certain movies, which will go unnamed, are even being made now by people writing fan fiction and getting it published or posting it online and becoming famous. So when MJ says Aaron has a fan theory, like, there's already like this subtext of fan theory. Like, we're all like, fan theory, eye roll, this is so ridiculous. You know, and then, you know, then it leads to your fanfic, you know, that we get.
But I mean, am I wrong though? I mean, no, think about it critically and it, structurally from narrative, like no. So it solves some of the problems.
Yeah, I think it's a fine point. It doesn't really fix how the film flows. It makes it more interesting on another level, right, MJ?
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, there's plenty of movies that I do that from where I'm like, oh, I like to watch it like this guy is actually from this movie too, you know, because it's the same actor. Yeah, like I've for sure done that before. And that's actually what you're saying actually holds way more water than that. But yeah, I don't know if it fixes the convenience of Lawrence Fishburne. That's who we decided was in this movie. It fixes
yes, I decided it was a different actor too.
Yeah, it fixes the convenience of that, because I really don't like his whole part. It just is so convenient, and is like, I feel like he wakes up and literally just walks on screen and goes, time for the third act, dead.
Dead, that would be great. Dead.
And so I actually do like that, whether it's, you know, quote, a fan theory or not. I think it actually adds some level of text to why these specific people,
mm-hmm.
you know, why isn't it just like Barry, who's a bartender or whatever?
They're like, we already got one of you.
Yeah.
totally missed on this one. Well, so that's kind of an interesting thing, because we have woven in and out of this idea that there's fulfillment in life in kind of not doing what you had planned to do. And, you know, and Aurora has all these quotes through the film, and they kind of change based on, you know, where she is as a character through the film. And, you know, she at one point says, if you live an ordinary life, all you'll have are ordinary stories. But also is the same person who says you can't get so hung up on where you'd rather be that you forget to make the most of where you are. So we have these differing opinions about, like, what does a fulfilled life look like? And you have two people who are planning to go and have a new life on this planet that they've never been to, with people that they've probably for the most part never met. And their plan is to go and do good, or, you know, something similar on this new place. And that is how they see their life being fulfilled, especially for Aurora, who has these ideas of doing this thing that no one's ever done before and basically forsaking her friends to do it and her family to do it. But instead, they're doing something drastically different. And I think that was one of the things, despite, you know, the conflict, despite the accusations of misogyny, besides the conversations about agency and things like that, besides a very confusing kind of out of left field third act and the waking up of Gus, this thing that stuck with me when I left the film was kind of, what does a fulfilled life look like? And whether the writers of Passengers are meaning to or not, I feel like they have this idea that says, you know, it's not necessarily what you plan, but you can do great things without doing anything great. I want to use a different word than great, but I'm not. I mean, especially in a society that tells us success looks like X, Y, or Z. And they kind of look down upon people who choose to live a quieter life.
That's actually really interesting. And viewing it through the lens that we just gave Aaron a ton of crap for, about the ship waking them up, if it's the ship doing it, it's, you know, what they wanted to do versus what they were called to do.
Mm-hmm.
Aurora, not so much. That's, you know, Jim wakes her up,
but it's still gonna take two of them to do it. So,
yeah,
I mean,
it's still going to take two of them, and also the companionship for, you know, an isolated, lonely man. Mm-hmm. as well. But so if the ship is what wakes them up, they are called to the larger purpose of Jim is called to the larger purpose of saving 4,997 other lives.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal. And also, Jim and Aurora restore a garden. Like, that's what happens at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I'm 100% with you. I mean, I think it's a beautiful picture of all of that. It's one reason I love it. I mean, it has grown and grown on me every time I've seen it.
Is it not weird to anyone else? Because, MJ, you saying this and kind of talking about what they end up doing, I just now had this realization that, like,
they don't have kids.
Yeah, they don't have kids.
Okay, so. I just had this discussion online last week, and it started because, to your point earlier, Mikey, people have randomly, since this came out on Blu-ray, been starting threads in all the different Facebook groups that I'm in saying, why does no one like Passengers? Why does no one like Passengers? All these people are, like, popping up liking the movie. And one of the threads that was not a person that liked the movie actually was just completely flummoxed that they didn't have kids. And they were like, this is ridiculous. Like, why would they not choose to have kids? So it is pretty fascinating. I mean, I think my viewing of that is simply, it's the responsible thing to do, because if for some reason anybody died when they had a baby, well, the baby's, I mean, what's the baby going to do? You know, like, there's no
baby's
way to take care of the
baby.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's the responsible choice not to have kids. I think it's the selfless choice is to choose not to bring a life into the world that they can't control in any way, and they may, you know, be condemning to death in space as well. You never know how that's going to play out for them, but that's how I read it. But it is definitely weird.
Well, and also the kids aren't going to have the bracelets that will give them access to food or anything.
Oh, that's true.
Well, I mean, but then your parents are going to die. You just cut their bracelets off their hands, off their cold, dead hands.
No milk and cappuccino that. For you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I want to make it clear that I do not think that you have to have kids to have a fulfilling life. And the fact that they could just be together and love each other and be one another's like stalwart companions, especially what they overcame and the forgiveness that would have had to go into that. That's commendable in and of itself, and I think very fulfilling, especially when you see the results of their hard work over whatever the course of their life would be. But I think if you have multiple kids, like, I don't really, it doesn't seem like it would be that big of a drain on the thing, and your kids would hypothetically have companions, and you're in a fairly safe or sterile environment. Like, if something happens to somebody, it's probably happening to all of them. It's not like they're going to get hit by a car crossing the road or whatever, you know. I guess anything can happen because kids are kids, and they often try to jump off things. But that aside, I mean, like, you wouldn't have that problem of companionship. Like I said, especially if you had multiple children. It just seemed like an interesting, I would have actually wanted to see that movie. Like the kids grow up. Or, well, okay, so that leads me to one last question, because we're getting to about the time where we're going to start wrapping up. And I feel like, especially with all of Aaron's fan fiction, this is already, the stage has already been set for this. And I think we've talked about how the movie wasn't perfect. There's a number of issues that we could and have pointed out about this film. But I think we've all enjoyed it on some level, or at least now have come to like it a great deal. Enough to, again, we're writing fan fiction about it, Aaron. But I'm curious, having watched it and at least multiple times and looking back and having discussions online, what are one or two things that you would have either liked to have seen or would have done differently to make this movie, quote unquote, better?
Well, it's a 5-star movie for me. So you can laugh all you want. Stop. That's fine. It has propelled its way all the way up into my top 10 of last year.
This and Seven Samurai and
it is darn near pushing up against my top 100 of all time. It is. I adore it. So I think I would have liked a little bit more in the choosing of Aurora. Like MJ brought up, and you know, very rightfully so, you know, you're right. He doesn't, I was misremembering, I think, maybe because that's what I wanted. I wanted him to do a little more of a selection process, but he does just kind of choose her. Right. He just kind of zeroes in, picks one person, and then goes with it. I don't know that I like that as well, because I think it's definitely more based on looks. It's based on an initial physical attraction of, hey, I want the hot chick with me. I would have liked maybe a little bit of a deeper selection process there. The ending is not perfect as well. The waking up of,
it's like 5-star perfect, but like
Lawrence Fishburne.
Of Lawrence Fishburne. I'm saying it's a 5-star for me, but I rate movies purely on like enjoyment factor. But the Lawrence Fishburne aspect, I would have liked that to be a little more fleshed out. Maybe, you know, give us a clue if my fan theory is correct, or you know, have a more fleshed out, you know, thorough reason for him to wake up and for that to take place. And then Jim's actual saving of the ship. I think the only what fell apart for me in the very first viewing was the ending of the movie. And it does for a lot of people in the third act when they're trying to save the ship and there's just explosions going on and the tone really, really switches on us. And I don't mind it as much now because I like the overall story so much, but I will have to admit that the way in which it portrays Jim's, you know, managing to stay alive with this heat shield and magnetic boots or whatever, you know, and exhaust of a however gigantic nuclear based spaceship or whatever. It's a little bit unrealistic. So, yeah, I would have maybe tweaked that a little bit as well.
Mm. What about you, MJ?
Yeah, I like what you said about more of a selection process. I think it makes the end hit a little bit harder, too, when they realize it's not about them. It's about these 4,997 other people. If we see if there's a montage of him looking through files, trying to find who he wants to wake up, because then he gets to know at least a handful of other people. And we see him know that, you know, it makes those people very real to him in that moment. And it gives him, you know, it becomes a moral imperative for him at that moment. And it does in the movie, but I think it would have been a much easier thing to convey if we had seen that selection process go beyond, like, woke up from my hangover, like, that one. The second one is not my idea at all. It is Nerdwriter's idea of making it from Aurora's perspective.
Yeah.
I think that would be, I think, one, that would make the movie much more compelling. As it is for me, the movie kind of evaporates on my brain. It's pretty forgettable. But I think there's an intrigue to it if you make it, if it starts with her waking up. It also grounds her as the audience conduit character. She then has to figure out what's going on or what happened. And so I think it doesn't leave the viewer out to sea as much. But yeah, I think even my wife, who had not seen the video, was like, man, I feel like this would benefit if this were from her perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that helps the tone problems, which is one of my biggest issues. It seemed like it couldn't decide what type of movie it wanted to be. Like, hey, is this like a sci-fi exploration film? Is this a romantic comedy-ish? Is it action adventure? I mean, because all three of those things are in this film. And yeah. I think if you wake up and do exactly what the nerd writer said, or a couple of other things that you could have done, and start it from like Aurora's point of view, it wouldn't have been the same movie. It wouldn't have been a romantic comedy, but it could have had like a kind of like a suspense, you know, almost mystery kind of to it, but it could have still been endearing. Like, you know, there could have been someone else who has woken up that was trying to divide, like, there could have been other conflict in this thing, in the situation on the ship, and we never know, because we don't already, you know, pre-assume that Jim is a charming, lovable, whatever. Like, we have to question all his actions, and then it's not just Aurora that has to deal with her being woken up. Like, the audience has to deal with that. And then we can actually be in Aurora's shoes. And so we can be really mad at this guy that we didn't see walk around or run around and play basketball and get drunk and eat ice cream and do whatever until, and then we get to discover that he almost killed himself. And we can go in any direction. He can actually be someone who's very selfish and didn't really think about it that much. He just wanted to wake up a hot girl. Or he could actually be endearing, and we could be with her on that journey to learn to love Jim despite this awful thing he's done. Because, like I said, we learn he was going to kill himself, and we learn what he did. And, you know, she sees like videotapes or something like that, just anything that like helps us endear it to him. And then I don't think that problem that everyone has, that thing that Aaron, you talked about, that unforgivable moment that people can't get past. I think if the audience can get past it through her eyes, then it's not that big of a deal. As it stands, we love Jim, and they're like, well, yeah, but they never have to go on the journey of learning to love him, because they see it like in this wacky kind of third act, like, oh, I love him now, because I guess he sacrificed himself, sort of, but didn't for me. So,
yeah, I don't want that personally, but I can see how it would definitely, it would, I tell you, I'm against it, because I think that people want the easy way, and they want it to be spelled out for them. And I don't think that's real life. I think life is messy, and I think we make poor choices, just like Jim's. Now, maybe not to that extreme. And I think that sometimes we forgive people, and our friends and our family can look at us and go, why? You know, I mean, I've had relationships like this. I know personally where friends are like, why are you still, you know, connected to this person in your life? This person has no business still being there.
I'm right here, Aaron. You know,
but yet I come back on the show over and over, despite what I go through. Yeah. So, I mean, I like the messiness of that personally, but I do agree with you. I can see a world where a lot of people would be more apt to enjoy or more apt to buy it if they saw it happening more thoroughly, more fleshed out from her. Mm. So yeah, I can see that.
That's interesting that you use the word messy, because I really feel like, kind of like MJ's, at least I think MJ that you're saying, is that there is actually almost nothing messy about the way the film's portrayed now. It's pretty straightforward. It leaves almost no guesswork. Like when we don't get to wrestle with anything really in the film. And I want to wrestle with it. Like I'm fine disagreeing with it. I'm fine like not understanding why ultimately she did it, but. Or, you know, he did it either way. But in the film, we spend like the first act, like with him going, should I or shouldn't I? Should I or shouldn't I? And I was like, well, I saw the trailer. I know you do. So this really, I'm not.
Yeah.
Like, I know this is going to happen.
She's on the poster.
Yeah. I was like, yeah. So like that's not a point of conflict for me. Like I'm not with her. I think it's way messier to have people follow her on a journey, an imperfect journey, discovering a character that is messy. When I think of messy in this film, I think of like Jim having to reconcile his loneliness. That's messy. And I want things to be messy, and that's why I want it the other way, because I think having to, like I said, watch an imperfect person judge the actions of another imperfect person is one of the messiest things possible. So, like I said, that's why you can go anywhere you want with the film after that. She can end up with him. She can be like, hey, you know, it's just not going to happen. But I understand why you did it. Like she goes on a discovery of Jim's character, and wherever she lands, I can still disagree with it. 'Cause there's still going to be people who are like, well, once you find out what he does, it doesn't matter how lonely he was, you still can't do it. But I think that they could have made a better case, which I don't think they were trying to make a case for anything based on how straightforward the film was, that she should or shouldn't have forgiven him. And I think if you do it that other way and you see what happens, because like I said, this goes back to those conversations I have with people who are non-believers who think there are unforgivable things. When you actually have to dig down into the offender and see them as a human being that is flawed, and you have to look at yourself and realize that you're just as flawed, that is the most Christian perspective we can have. And I think that is the most compelling story, for people to have to deal with. And
yeah,
I mean, MJ said, yeah. And so I want you to start talking now, MJ, so you can back me up here.
No, I agree, because I think it can become this, you know, idea of, and even maybe even adding flashbacks into how kind of selfish she's being by doing this whole return trip thing. Mm-hmm. And showing her friends on Earth being like, what the heck, man? Like, no one's going to be here when you're not there. And it can become this very like, you know, Speck and Plank type of thing, you know?
Which is at the heart of, I think, forgiveness in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But as the movie stands, I just feel like it kind of sets the audience adrift and is like, this is happening. It's a very passive viewing experience, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that restructuring of it can make it can really engage people a lot more.
Mm-hmm. And we're all about engagement. But so we say all that, and I say, I still managed to enjoy it the way it was. So, you know, it wasn't a total loss, but it does make me think. And I think by proxy, thinking about ways that I would have hopefully improved the movie, or someone could have improved the movie, make me think about the ideas of forgiveness and what makes forgiveness complicated, even though the movie I don't think really directly kind of engages that. So, hey, I mean, it's kind of win-win. I mean, I don't think everyone's going to have like an hour and a half conversation about it like we just did, but maybe they should, because then they can really talk about how messy forgiveness really is. And that would be great, because I think it is messy, but I think it's worth it. Mm-hmm. And it's a bummer. It's a bummer that people like aren't on that page, but I get it, but it's hard. It's like one of the most difficult things in the world to take on someone else's pain.
And you know, I mean, Mikey, part of the reason we enjoy it too is, you know, the production value in this film.
Oh, it's
is
pretty
phenomenal.
It's so it's phenomenal. Beautiful.
It's gorgeous. I mean, the anti-gravity or loss of gravity mm-hmm. pool scene is fantastic. Things like that, the spacewalks, all that stuff's great.
Yeah, I think someone pointed out the constant kind of portrayal of like these really wide shots, these really like long, like far away kind of shots to show just how, well, especially in the first act where it shows how lonely Jim is, you know, just how by himself and empty space is to try to get us to understand like the this whole concept of being alone, you know, of loneliness. And and when she's awake, it's still to kind of open up this concept that it's still just them. You know, it's look, there's just nothing around here. And it totally sets I think a pretty good framework for understanding what's going on. And, you know, when you can make the setting almost, I don't want to say it's a setting's a character, it's such a cliche, but when the setting adds a lot, and has a
it's
point.
A sentient spaceship, it can be a character.
it's a sentient spaceship that just wants to make love to another sentient spaceship and have little spaceship babies. Sincerely, Aaron White.
Is this Aaron's fanfic or is this Mikey's fanfic that he's pinning on Aaron?
I think so, yeah.
I might have a nom de plume. It's Aaron White. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and when I left that movie, I was like, you know what? No matter how bad people think this movie is, no matter my issues with the film, there is a lot here, which is usually the only reason I'm super disappointed in the film, because there are so many things that we just talked about that I think lots of people won't actually have a conversation about when they leave this film, or that when they finish watching this film, or if they ever get to rent this movie from MJ's library. Like they won't probably have these conversations. That's a bummer, because I think this is a really great conversation. And even though we only skim the surface of some of the most important ones, I still think that's great. I still think hopefully someone will hear this and they'll be like, you know what? Maybe I should have this conversation. Maybe I'm very mad at the guys, on that Real World Theology episode, because they didn't take misogyny serious enough. Like I want to talk to those people. Yeah. I want to continue that conversation, because I think lots of these things are very important and we just don't have enough time to talk about everything. So with that said, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to be on this episode. I'm glad that we finally got to talk about Passengers, the 2016 mascot of Real World Theology. I think great conversations happen because you have great guests. So I want to make sure that everyone has a chance to follow the work that you guys are doing, because outside of being a guest on this show, you guys are doing really great stuff in the field of entertainment. So MJ, what are some ways that people can follow what you do?
Oh gosh, I am all over the dang internet these days. at MJSmith891 on Twitter. That's 891, the numbers. On Twitter, all my stuff gets filtered through there. I have a podcast called The Before and After Show. That's all about expectations versus the final viewing experience. So you should check that out. It's on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, any RSS app that you use, any Podburner app that you use on your Android device. I have a YouTube channel called Real Perspective. That's R-E-E-L Perspective. Get it? where we kind of do these macro level breakdowns of things related to what's going on in the world of movies. I write for Word of the Nerd online. It's wordofthenerd.com, Word of the Nerd. I do news and reviews for them. And then I also do reviews for KeithLovesMovies.com. So that's all the spots.
And I will probably have to have you message all of that to me so I can make sure it's all in the show notes.
Holy cow. Sure. You're a busy man.
Exactly.
It's outrageous.
Yeah, what do the 891 stand for? I would say that MJ is living a fulfilled life while the rest of us, we're just on a spaceship hurtling to oblivion, not having kids.
Not so, having little spaceship babies.
Yeah.
It's because he tried online dating.
That's right.
See?
There you go. That's the takeaway here. If you're 0 for 1 in online dating, you should try again and you'll meet your wife, according to MJ. So
yeah, guaranteed.
What does the 891 mean after your Twitter handle?
My personal email address is mjsmith891@gmail.com, and so I just transferred it over to my Twitter handle.
Oh, man, but now everyone knows your email.
Oh, I left out a key component of it.
You need to make up. You need to make
that's
up.
That's not actually the whole thing. So.
Nice.
So, I think I felt like I interrupted you. Was there anything else, MJ?
No, that's it.
Okay, cool. Aaron, same question, man. What do you got going on, and how can people get up on it?
All over the internet at Aaron L White AaronElWhite. You can plug that in. Find me on Twitter, Facebook, etc. Love to chat, love to talk all day long. According to my friends, I don't have a job, so I'm always available. I do have a show called Feelin' Film, the Feelin' Film podcast, also available anywhere you can get podcasts, just like MJ was saying earlier, iTunes, Stitcher, etc. We try to take more of an emotional perspective on films, which you probably figured now that you've heard me speak about Passengers and how I think. So if that's something that interests you, we have good conversation, I think, and had a lot of fun being in existence for the last year. So you can check that out at Feelin' Film, FeelinFilm website, you know, feelinfilm.com, et cetera, et cetera.
And all that jazz, the thing that Ryan Gosling is married to. So
just
anyway,
a Criterion copy of the film All That Jazz.
That's right. Let's see. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter, where I am not nearly as funny as I am in real life. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the show. You can find this podcast, like everyone else, at all the places you can find podcasts. So please do it. If you've found us on iTunes or wherever, and they allow you to rate or positively like in any way our podcast, I would love for you to do that. I think we've actually gotten one or two new reviews, and I need to write them down so I can give them a shout out on the show. So if you've done that, thank you very much. I'll read those the next time I have an episode. And for Real World Theology, you know, I'm Fizz, and I just wanted to remind you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Do you want to die?
No.
Why not, Aaron? You could just be with Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
Is it really that good of a point? I basically just asked you if you wanted
Jennifer
to die.
Lawrence, Jesus.
I just tried to Jesus juke a death threat, basically. So yeah. I've got an idea for you, Aaron. If you want to do more stuff, maybe you should try getting a job.
Oh, man.
Stop living off my dime.
Just saying.
Apparently it's a thing for me to get black actors' names confused.
Yeah.
That's not great, Aaron.
That's really...
I know, right? I'm not hanging my hat on it.
Yeah, you're kind of saying it like, oh, that's just a thing that I get wrong. How quirky Aaron is. No, that's actually really bad, Aaron.
Mikey doesn't edit. This is the one thing I've learned. You have to be very careful what you say on Real World Theology because he doesn't edit. So
I do edit.
You accidentally call Brian Singer an atheist, he just leaves it in there.
Yeah. I don't see a problem with that.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
It's too late now.